Welcome to this episode of Tea with Twiggy. It's great to have you here. This is a podcast where I catch up with friends and people that I find fascinating. I check that they're doing okay and ask for tips to help us stay at home more comfortable. My guest this week is one of Britain's most talented and versatile actors, who has turned his hand to everything from Shakespeare to sitcoms. He's won a BAFTA, a Tony, and multiple Olivier Awards, starred in Hollywood movies and some of my favourite British comedies. You might know him best as Ben Harper from My Family. I'm delighted to be having a cup of tea with the fabulous Robert Lindsay. Robert Lindsay, hello.
I love the way you said that. That was a bit sultry for you, Twigs.
It can be very fun.
Robert Lindsay, hello.
Lindsay.
Ding
Thank
dong.
You for having, I wish we were having proper tea together, but.
Well, we will. You know, let's be optimistic. It won't be, I don't think it's going to last that long.
Or will it?
I don't know. Who knows?
Anyway, what's your tipple today? I've got the South African tea, Rooibos, isn't it called?
Well, I rather like that tea. Have you seen the gag where they're drinking tea like this on screen, on Zoom or something, and then they have a tea bag hanging over the cup, but it's full of red wine. So people think they're drinking tea. This is the thing of Zoom. And of course, nobody's wearing trousers on Zoom either. You know, they're all semi-naked and drinking red wine.
And getting sozzled in the...
Well, the first 2 weeks of lockdown, I got very down about the whole thing because of, you know, my son's in A-levels and I was in the middle of a production that has been shelved and I went into a bit of a downer. So I started drinking a bit and finding myself drinking at 4 in the afternoon and really weird, things I've never really done. And I'm waking up in the mornings thinking I've got the dreaded COVID-19 and my wife had to keep reminding me I had a hangover.
But I know what you mean. What were you in the middle of doing? Were you shooting something?
I just finished the play that I talked to you about last year about the cinematographer Jack Cardiff, which has now been developed into a movie, which is very exciting. And the script at the moment is with a gentleman called Martin Scorsese. Who was a huge fan of Jack Cardiff, you know, and he wrote the foreword to the book that the play is based on. It's a fantastic story, Twigs, and you never did come and see it. And
hold on a minute. You were going to tell
That's
us
true.
When you were in Richmond and you forgot.
No, I did.
You forgot
did
about me, Bob. You forgot.
No, I did.
And
I got. But you were in the middle of all sorts of things as well. You were in the middle of moving home and stuff like that. So, yes. But
upset we missed it. Well, we'll have to go.
Well you may not. But I think now because of this dreaded disease, I can't see theatre opening for a very long time, which
I
is. I mean, it's awful for our profession, really.
It is terrible for young actors, but for all actors.
Well, you know, I've got kids, friends of mine who've just left drama school, you know, and your normal procedure, of course, is you get an agent and then you join Equity and then you go into rep and you do your thing and all those things are not going to happen. I've just recorded something for the Northcote Theatre in Exeter, which was my first job when I left drama school. And ironically, would you believe, Twigs, it was a play called Roses of Eam. And Eam is a village in Derbyshire which had the plague. And I've just recorded a speech from it, which I think we're going to put out on social media. It's the most incredible speech. John Nettles played it in the play we did in Exeter. We didn't then televised it, but he persuades the villagers to stay in the village and they put a circle of stones around the village.
Wow.
And he made them stay and said, listen, the plague is only here, but if you leave this village, you'll take the plague with you. It's in every pore of your skin, every fold of every touch of piece of your hair. And he persuades them to stay. And of course, quite a few of them died.
Yeah.
And that's where Ring a Ring of Roses, A Pocket Full of Posies come from.
Oh,
A tissue, we all fall down. That's where the song comes from.
Yeah, I knew it was about the play, but I didn't know it was from that story. And that's
an incredible story, because the tailor and the house is still there in Eyam, which is a village about 20 miles from where I was born. So I used to go.
You were born from up in.
Well, I was born in Ilkeston in Derbyshire, which is about 20, 30 miles from Eyam itself. So I used to bike ride there a lot as a kid, and it's a spooky place.
Is it?
I mean, well, yeah, because they're all plague cottages. They're all as it was at the time, and it was a tailor who received a trunk of clothing from London, which contained the plague. And of course, it just spread like wildfire.
Oh, my goodness.
But how weird. I did that 50 years ago at the Northcott. And here it is again.
Unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, it just suddenly hit us all, didn't it? Last time I saw you was at your birthday. And
My birthday.
I'd had mine a few months. So I'm a little bit older than you. But we're born the same year.
Well, you see, we were talking about that this morning. And you see, you've been going a lot longer than me. Because when we were both teenagers, mm-hmm. I was a pimply schoolboy and you were a global superstar. And that's why I can never work out how you're older than me or the same age as me. I would have thought you'd be ancient by now.
Well, I am pretty ancient, but...
You certainly aren't, my darling.
Oh, well, thank you. But, you know, you've got to remember what happened to me. I was really young. I was 16 when that all madness happened.
In fact, my 16-year-old just walked through the room at the moment. He was the same age.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what an extraordinary story, really.
Well, it shouldn't have happened, really. I mean, I was as shocked as the rest of the world. I thought they'd all gone mad. But...
You're just a kid.
Oh, I was.
In your head.
Yeah. And I was a very, I mean, I'm not like, I wasn't like the sophisticated 16-year-olds there are today. I was so, you know, in those, this was in the, you know, mid-60s, which I know was meant to be swinging, but I was in Neasden in northwest London. I was not swinging.
No, Neasden was not swinging, darling, was it? You weren't swinging in Neasden. There's a book.
That's a good title.
Swinging in Neasden.
So, you know, it was madness. But, and it just, when it happened, it just kept, you know, rolling over and over. And, you know, I had no control over it, really. I mean, it was great. I loved it.
Did you do exams then?
No, I was in the middle of what we then called O-levels.
Which was CSEs.
Yeah, CSEs.
GCSEs.
No,
then.
I was
they
in
were
mid, and I actually loved school. I was ready to carry on. I wanted to go to art school. I wanted to become a designer. I wanted to be a dress designer.
Well, you are.
Well, I am now, but I wanted to do it when I was 17. I didn't have what happened to me in my head, you know.
So, what was the first time it happened? What was it? Was it the famous portrait of you, or?
Yeah, I think so. It was the haircut, and you know, somebody saw me. Somebody wanted to take a picture. They sent me to have my hair done. Leonard cut my hair, and that was it. A fashion journalist saw the picture, and I was
Bob's
painting my eyes in that way because you know all girls play with makeup, and I had a rag doll that had all painted eyes. And
what happened to your friends?
Well, it was weird. Yeah, I kind of I lost them because within 3 months I was in Paris, within 8 months I was in New York.
I know.
It was weird, wasn't it? Weird. And actually, when they did, it wasn't This Is Your Life. It was one of those where they get people back to meet you. And I hadn't seen any of them for 40-odd years. And they got them all back. It was weird.
That is weird, isn't it? I'm not sure I like reunions that much.
Bit strange. I had no control over it because they did it. But how old were you when... I mean, you got into RADA, didn't you? RADA.
Yeah, but no, I was 16 when I left school.
Uh-huh.
I was at a secondary modern school. I failed my 11 plus.
Oh, I passed mine, darling.
Yeah, I thought you might in Neasden. But... I was meant to pass my 11 plus because I was actually quite a bright boy at my junior school.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, no one told me I was taking the 11 plus. I just turned up one morning and there were pencils on my desk and some paper. So I was a bit mystified. I thought, oh, what's going on? And anyway, I failed. And I went to a secondary modern school, which was a very tough, rough school called Gladstone Boys. It had a very notorious reputation for bullying, and it was a tough old place. In fact, the school uniform was a leather jacket and a bike chain.
Oh!
If I can give you some idea of what it was like. So, and that was the mid, you know, the 50s. No, the beginning of the 60s. Yeah. But there was an amazing man there called John Lally, who was my art teacher. He eventually became the headmaster, and he started this thing called the Grand Order of Thespians, which was quite an achievement to organise in a school of thugs, because everyone wanted to be James Dean at that time, rockers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, literally, people used to turn up in leather jackets. I mean, that was... Anyway, John started this organisation called Grand Order of Thespians, and we started putting on plays. And he got everyone involved. He got everyone doing the maths, doing the box office, the maths department, the makeup, the metalwork and woodwork department, making the sets. And, of course, I was cast as the lead role in the first play ever called The Pied Piper. That was my first ever performance on stage.
Aww.
But I went to see my careers master when I was 16, Brock Levers, I remember him, and he said, so what we're doing, Stevenson, my real name, Stevenson, what we're doing, Stevenson, when we leave school? I said, I think I'm going to be an actor, sir. And he said, a what? What do they do? I said, well, they act, sir. He said, the act? He said, have you considered taking a career in hairdressing? Because, you see, mentioning acting and theatre in a mining town in the East Midlands in the 1960s was not a respectable job.
It could have been.
Anyway, the long and short of it was John got me into a college called Clarendon College in Nottingham, and I did a two-year course there before I went to RADA at 18.
Wow. So, you know, I often ask people if there was one particular special person who changed their life, and it's got to be that teacher.
Oh, it's John Lally, without doubt. Yeah, he was an amazing man. And I, in fact, I got a picture of him right here in my office. And, there was a very moving moment when I went back to Nottingham for the first time after many, many TV roles and things. And I was doing a play at the Nottingham Theatre Royal with the Old Vic Company, and he came on stage. He wanted to go on stage after the show, and he came on and he put his arm around me and he looked at it and he said, I can't believe that you're here. Aww. That you did it, and I'm so proud of you. And he started crying.
Oh, how lovely.
And it was a very special man. I loved him.
It's amazing that often it is a teacher that is the special person in somebody's life and actually turns their life around.
It's happened to my boys, actually. I think there comes a point when parents are no longer useful in terms of information. No, I'm serious. I think it's a teacher that is the next step on in life. Someone who's objective, who sees things. You kind of lose your children. You kind of lose where they're going, and you probably smell. I mean, certainly I'm very self preoccupied. I think that's a problem with our profession, I think. But both my boys have found their tutor, their person that's going to move
wonderful.
Them on.
But you do find that your kids do kind of come back when they get a little bit older. You know,
I think they're 7-year cycles, I think.
Oh, interesting.
I'm sure of it. That's when. Yeah, my boys have gone into their seventh cycle at the moment. I don't know where they are. They've spun off into space somewhere. I think one of them are running Venezuela soon, I think.
After you came out of RADA, did you know
I was RADA? That was a difficult thing because they changed my accent. Because when I was at RADA, talk like that, you see, from Ilkeston, talk like that. And they said, you can't have a career in Shakespeare if you carry on talking like that, you see, Mr. Lindsay. So I had. A, to change my name to Lindsay, because there was a Robert Stevens in the profession. Oh, so yes. They changed my name. And then I went back to my small mining town at odd weekends to be fed by my mother, because I wasn't eating in London. But I started talking like this, you see, because I was now having elocution lessons and speaking terribly, terribly, sounding a little bit like Donald Sinden. And, of course, they all thought I was totally insane.
So funny.
Which is true.
It's true because Lee, you know Lee, your great friend.
I was at drama school you with were Lee.
At drama school, but he had a Midlands accent because he's from Warwickshire.
Yes, and when I met him, I can't imagine Lee because he was so posh.
I know.
When
I met him, I thought he was really posh, but I was probably posher than him. Which is quite
no, that's not possible. Really? Now, come on, Twigs, let's get real here.
But I love it because occasionally he'll do his kind of Midlands accent and it's hysterical coming out of his mouth. But you're right, yes. Rada, I don't think they do that anymore, do they? They let you keep your regional accent.
Well, life's changed, you know. That dialect and accents are cool now.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And quite rightly. Well, aren't I right in thinking that, you know, Shakespeare and all the actors that from his troupe must have had regional accents? No?
I wonder. Well, there must be other people from Neasden in Shakespeare's company, because it was a London-based theatre, you see. So, you see, when Lee was in finals when I got to RADA, and of course, Richard Beckinsale was in these... Lovely, the late and great Richard Beckinsale. And now Richard was very Nottingham.
Oh, was he? That's interesting.
Yeah, but when I got there, you see, both Lee and Richard and everything, they'd all lost their accents. And in fact, I sort of vaguely remember talking to Beckinsale when I got there, because we were at the same college in Nottingham together as well.
Oh, okay.
And he was always 2 years ahead of me, or a year and a half ahead of me. And I remember him saying, they'll really drum it out of you. Here. They won't accept accents, and it's a curious thing losing your accent, because you lose your personality. You don't know it. You still feel the same, but people behave very differently. The people from your background, like your friends that you lost contact with,
I lost contact through what happened to me, not from really. I didn't really change. What happened to me changed me. You know.
But it's still a class thing.
Yes,
it's still
absolutely.
A thing that, of yeah. success and yeah. and speech. And yes, it's all to do with success.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, because when I within a year of that happening to me, I was in New York and you know, people like Sonny and Cher in L.A. gave me a party, and Clint Eastwood threw a party. I mean, it was like insane.
Wow.
You know, I was 17, wow. 17 yeah, I know. Years
they do,
old.
They do live well in New York, don't they? Actually, that reminds me. That's one of the times I saw you. Do you remember? We met in Joe Allen's after Me and My Girl.
Yeah, that's that's when I saw you. Because I didn't see the London version.
No, I
saw because
that's right.
I think I was on stage in doing my one and only when you were
and
doing
And do you
it.
Remember who appeared underneath the table?
When we came to, was it?
Joe Allen's. We were having supper at Joe Allen's with my ex-partner, Di.
Yeah.
And you and Lee. And we were sitting having dinner in Joe Allen's, and suddenly a hand appeared underneath the table about my crotch height.
Was it?
And it was Betty Bacall.
I'd say Betty Bacall because she loved you so much.
It was a bit spooky, wasn't it? It's a bit spooky.
But you, I have to say, that performance in Me and My Girl, you were so brilliant.
I loved it.
You got the Tony for that, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And in fact, funny enough, Sam, my son, only saw the other day the Tony Awards and doing the Lambeth Walk in the theatre.
Brilliant.
And he went, Dad, I didn't know it. I had no idea you were that successful.
Oh, my God. You were. That scene where you come in the room and you've been riding a horse.
Oh, yeah.
I think I laughed. I got so hysterical. I could not stop. And the whole theatre, you know, when it doesn't happen very often, but when the whole theatre just get hysterical with laughter It was just so funny. It was brilliant.
It was an extraordinary time. I loved every minute of it. You know, Paul Newman tried to get a film made of it, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he used to take me out for I'm dropping names like mad now, but then we're allowed to do that in our industry.
Well, I am too, but why not? If we know them, let's flaunt them.
If we know them, absolutely. If you got it, flaunt it.
Exactly.
Actually, funny enough, talking about, I've got to mention this because Lee asked me about this. What? You know, the other day during lockdown, I took the dogs for a walk. And I'm absolutely paranoid about talking to people or getting close to people, especially joggers or cyclists or anything. So, but this woman came running towards me. She said, "Oh, hello, it's you. It's you of, oh, you're in that, oh, I remember. Oh, you're so good. And what's the program?" And I said, "Let's keep our distance." She said, "No, I've not seen that one." I had to mention that because it was
That's
so silly.
So brilliant. That is so brilliant. The thing that made you really, really famous in this country was Sisterton Smith, wasn't it?
Oh, Wolfie, yeah. Oh, God, and still
that
is.
That was so brilliant. That was so brilliant.
It was of its time.
But people still remember it, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, our dinner party, when we had my birthday party, that's the first thing the restaurateur said. It's Wolfie. Wolfie's 70th. Years ago, you remember the BBC used to have these like entertainment parties?
Yeah.
And it was usually on a Friday night, and it was a huge gathering of Morecambe and Wise, and da da da, and it was fantastic. And I used to go, and there was Ronnie Barker and the two Ronnies, and then of course the cast of Only Fools and Horses.
Oh,
and
wow.
We were all a little bit worse for wear leaving that evening, and I was walking down to the gates at what's he called? Not White Hart Lane.
Shepherd's
Wood Lane.
Wood Lane, yeah.
Wood Lane Studios with Nick Lyndhurst from
Only Fools and Horses.
Only Fools and Horses. I'm walking towards the gate and we're hailing a cab. We're a little bit worse for wear. And a cab goes past and shouts out, "Plonker!" And then another cab goes past and sees me and goes, "Power to the people!" And Nick Lyndhurst looked at me and he said, "I wish I had your catchphrase."
Exactly what I want to have, Plonker. That's so funny. That's amazing. But that must have changed your life, Sisterton Smith, yeah?
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, probably had the same impact on me as probably Twiggy did on you.
I'd say you probably couldn't go anywhere.
I mean, I was
anywhere.
A teen idol for couldn't walk anywhere. I left the series after 3 series, I think it was, and then I was so desperate to go back to the theatre, which is what I really wanted to do. I didn't never aim to do sitcom after sitcom, and certainly not be a cult idol on TV. And so I went to do plays at the Royal Exchange in Manchester, culminating in Hamlet, which I did there. And I remember going to the theatre one day, a matinee, and there was a guy on a roof, a builder, with a tin hat on. Mm-hmm. And he saw me and he shouted, "Power to the people." And I immediately, instinctively put my fist up and replied, "Power to the people" back. At which point he slid down the tiles of this shop with all the tiles rattling into the road. He hit the guttering, grabbed onto the guttering, which snapped. He hit a shop awning. The shop awning gave way under his weight. And he walked across the road and asked me for my autograph.
That's so funny.
And I remember going to the theatre. I was in shock. And a lot of people in Manchester were as well. There was a crowd of people watching this event. I got into the theatre and I said to Bram Murray, "Bram, much as I love doing Hamlet, and I'm so proud that you've cast me and done this and that," I said, "but I'm never going to be or escape from Wolfie Smith." And he said, "Come here. Look out that window. You see the line of people waiting for tickets? That's what they're coming to see." And I said, "Yeah, but they're coming to see Wolfie Smith play Hamlet." He said, "Doesn't matter. Yeah. We're full."
But also, the nice part of that story is it probably brought people into the theatre who'd never been to the theatre.
That's right.
And I think that's good. And maybe we'll make them go back when they can. It's going to be a while, but...
Actually, let's go back. I'm going to ask you something now. And, of course, the first time I ever saw you on stage, actually, I didn't see the production on Broadway, but My One and Only. Mm-hmm. What year was that?
I did My One and Only from May 1983 until the November of 84. So about a year and
that's
a half.
That's right, because we opened in Leicester in 1984.
In Me and My Girl.
Yeah, and we ran from 84 to 86 in the Adelphi, and then I went to New York and LA leading up to 87. So we were, it was almost in conjunction.
I know,
with
that's
each
interesting,
other.
Isn't it?
Yeah, but with the lovely Tommy Tune.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I met Tommy because he got cast in The Boyfriend, the film I did with Ken Russell, my first film.
Which a film I love.
Oh, it's very sweet. It's the only kind of
sweet adorable.
Ken Russell
film. It's a fantastic film.
It's a sweet film. But, you know, I got Tommy cast because at the time Ken was trying to cast that, it's the role of the American boy, and he wouldn't fly, Ken Russell. And he said, you know, I don't know any Americans here. And I'd seen Tommy on television in America. And I said, you've got to see this guy. You know, he's amazing looking. He's one of the best tap dancers I've ever seen. He's 6'6". And immediately Ken loved him because he was slightly unusual. And he cast him. And that's how I met Tommy on The Boyfriend. And then 12 years later... You know, he'd become this really big Broadway director. And he rang me and said, because we'd had a project we'd tried to do after The Boyfriend, another film, and it all fell apart. We couldn't get the money raised. But we kept in touch. And he rang me in like 82 and said, I think I've got our project going. And I said, oh, when do we start filming? And he said, no, it's going to be on Broadway. And I said, I can't do that. And he said, there's no such word as can't. Pack your bags and get out to New York.
Oh, I didn't realise The Boyfriend was prior to My One
That's
and
how
Only.
I met Tommy. But he's right, actually, because the thought of going on a Broadway stage put the fear of God into me.
You won the Tony, didn't
no,
you?
No, I was nominated, but I didn't win. He won for... We didn't win Best Musical. He won for Best Actor. And Honey Coles, our wonderful older tap dancer, who was one of the greatest tap dancers ever, he won Best Supporting...
Name.
And I lost out to a beautiful actress. Well, she was a ballet dancer, actually, in On Your Toes. I can't remember her name.
Oh,
Natalia Marikova or something like that.
Marikova.
Yeah. I mean, she was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And what was that Broadway experience like for you? I mean, it was a huge success.
Unbelievable.
It's incredible, wasn't it?
Unbelievable. But you know that feeling. It's like... When you're in a hit show on Broadway, the whole town envelops you, don't they? I mean, with love. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone knows you. You go into restaurants, everyone comes up and talks to you, you know.
Did you have the gypsy robe ceremony?
What's that?
On the first night, you probably didn't go to it or you probably weren't aware of it, but every show that opens on Broadway, a coat... Of all the shows, with all the shows, memorabilia or posters or whatever, is passed to the new show that's opening on Broadway.
Wow.
It's called the Gypsy Robe Ceremony, because we're all gypsies. And, I remember going to it. It was very moving, because the show that handed it to us was a show called Lipstick, which I think was a Stephen Schwartz show. Which closed after a few nights and or weeks.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing about Broadway, which you can't explain to anyone, because I went to an opening night after we'd opened, which was extraordinary. I mean, it was a huge success.
Oh, I know.
I never unpacked until I saw the reviews.
That's right.
No, I was convinced I was going home. But I went to a first night, which our director, Mike Ockrent, of Me and My Girl had done, and... it was Rowan Atkinson's show that he'd done, and which Stephen Fry was in. And we were all at the party afterwards. I came and joined them at the party after the show. And there was Rowan and Mike and Stephen, and we're all having a glass of champagne. And then in the corner of the room, this PR lady appeared with a copy of the New York Times and did that signal across her neck, which meant that the review from Frank Rich had been appalling. And Rowan never went on again.
That's right. They closed the show, didn't they?
He closed it. They closed it that night.
Yeah, that happened to another actor friend of Lee's who I didn't know. And they actually closed the bar. The people were in the middle of pouring champagne and they closed the bar and brought the, you know, those metal things in. And they all...
Yeah, they don't mess around in New York.
And they were all on the plane home the next day. Wow. That was a drama. I don't know what the play was, but... No, they were... Well, thank God. I mean, Frank Rich, I know, loved you and he loved me. So we were lucky.
We were lucky, babe.
Oh, gosh.
But what an experience, though.
Unbelievable. What an experience. It was one of the... Professionally, it was one of the most amazing experiences. Mainly because I didn't think I could do it. Do you know what I mean? Because I'd never done that before.
Me too. I felt the same. I mean, I've never danced in my life, you know, and I had a crash course in... tap dancing and
but you were brilliant and all the songs.
Well,
and there's something about just, doing a musical, isn't it? It's amazing because the uplift, the orchestra.
I never ever tired of doing it. Mind you, that doesn't apply now. I get very bored very quickly.
Oh, do
but
you?
I'm a bit of a once the first night's over, I want to do something else.
I've done it, done that, been there,
done that one. Let's get that out of the way. But see, we have the really weird thing of introducing the Cockney accent to the New York Manhattanites. My opening rehearsal with a guy called Stanley Lebowski, who was the musical director, and he said, "Bob, what are we going to do?" I said, "Well, do me and my girl, okay?" And we said, "No, it's Bob. It's me and my gal." And, you know, I said, "No, no, no. We sing it, me and my girl." It's all very London and very. And then he said, "Well, what's this Hovis?" I said, "Well, it's brown bread, Stanley." He said, "Well, what? I don't get it. What does it mean?" I said, "Well, my parents are Ovis, mate. Means they're dead." "Well, how can Ovis mean they're dead?" "No, no, no. Brown bread is dead. So." And Hovis is a brown bread in England. Right. Okay. "Bob, why don't we change it to whole wheat or rye?" I said, "Well, Stanley, that's not going to rhyme, is it?" He said, "Well, neither does Hovis." I said, forget it. It was crazy.
That is hysterical. But they loved it. I mean, you know.
Can you believe it? I know. No. It was. And the weird thing was, though, when we were in L.A., we were at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, that huge, where the Oscars are held, you know, that huge amphitheatre of a... And of course, in LA, of course, if you're seen after 9 o'clock, it means you're not working. So, so it didn't do terribly well. And the press were very lukewarm about it. But one of the chorus boys, who was Barry, who was a brilliant dancer, came up to me and he said, "You wait till we get to New York. It's a whole different ballgame."
LA is not a theatre town, really.
No, it's certainly not.
It really isn't. We've had friends who live there, you know, and if they were doing a stage play, if a call came through about a TV series, or they just left. They left the play. It was unbelievable. It's just not. Did you never lived in LA, did you?
I did.
Oh,
yeah.
You did?
I did.
When?
I found it very weird. When I did Me and My Girl, I got involved with a man called Carl Reiner.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
And Mel Brooks. And but as I said earlier, Paul Newman was desperate to get a movie on its feet of Me and My Girl. And he kept taking us out for dinner and showing us footage he'd got of Lupino Lane and the play and... saying he got some screenwriters and he can get some finance and then he'd spoken to Spielberg and I think, oh my God. But that was all intervened by Rob Reiner and Carl Reiner, sorry, and Mel Brooks, who came in and persuaded me to do a movie, which unfortunately I have great fond memories of, but it didn't kind of happen. And it was a dance film and it was about a mining town in the East Midlands. It was sort of biographical in many ways, but it was a disaster. In fact, I remember the first English review, Barry Norman, and it said, Robert Lindsay's wonderful, but is run over by his own vehicle.
Oh, dear.
That's a good one, isn't it?
Oh, I've got a better one. The boyfriend, I think it was Donald Zeck. Do you remember him, the critic?
Yeah, yeah.
Said, Twiggy looks like chewed up chicken legs that have been posted through a letterbox. What does that mean? I don't even know what it means. But isn't it interesting how you remember the horrible things written? And you don't remember
the
nice things.
That's the crazy thing about our thing. My wife's constantly saying to me, why are you always looking on the dark side? You always pick on the bad review.
But if
look at the good ones.
You remember the bad ones. That's why.
I know. I know when I did Hamlet, which was very reviewed quite well, but the only weird review I got was Time Out. When we did it in London, we came to London with it, and they didn't mention my name.
Why?
I was playing Hamlet. They didn't mention my name. They didn't mention Hamlet. They mentioned Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and Claudius. And I kept looking for the review. I go, I'm not in it.
That is so funny. That is hysterical. How can they do that?
They did it.
But you've done quite a lot of Shakespeare, weren't you? Didn't you join the Shakespeare Company in Stratford for a little bit?
I did. Yeah. I did a lot of those BBC ones that they did, which they call the Creaky Floorboard Productions that Cedric Messina did for the BBC. And then I did Olivier's Aaliyah at Granada, which was...
Was that an amazing experience?
Well, it was because he was on his last legs and he was very poorly.
Oh.
And for, about 3 weeks of the rehearsal period, he didn't turn up. And we had an understudy, a young boy from Brighton, who came up to read while you had this extraordinary cast of Diana Rigg, Dorothy Tutin,
wow.
John Hurt, Ilya McKern, Colin Blakely, David Threlfall, me. It was an incredible cast. And Threlfall and I were always doing Olivier impersonations. We were so excited to be working with the great man. And I know one day when he'd not been there, Threlfall and I were doing Richard the Third. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of yours. And he walked in. He was standing behind us while we were doing it.
Yes. Did he say anything?
No, he did. But then he cut our sword fight. We had a huge sword fight, which he came to view and he deliberately cut it. He said it was too long. It's too long. But I tell you a story. I must tell you a Larry Olivier story. When we were filming it, you know that, remember that big rehearsal, the makeup room at Granada Studios?
Yeah.
It was vast and everyone used to be in there. Coronation Street and whatever chat show was there. And it was packed with, and all the Lear actors, King Lear, were all in their wigs and beards and stuff. And Larry, who had his throne, he had a throne that he sat on for his makeup. Was told that Annie Walker from Coronation Street was sitting on the other side of the makeup room. So he went over with his crown, walked all the way down and looked into her mirror. And he said, my darling girl, on behalf of the entire theatrical community, I'd like to say we just welcome you and your performance. It has given such spirit and warmth to the entire generation of people. And you, my darling girl, deserve every honour and accolade you can receive. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And went back to his seat.
Brilliant.
Sat on his throne. And Annie Walker looked in the mirror and makeup girl and said, who's that?
Is that true? That's an amazing story.
It's absolutely true.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, what an experience. I never worked with him, but when we were going to open in My One and Only... you know, the producer said, Gene Olsen, famous people we can invite to the first night. And and I didn't know Olivier, but somebody said, what about Laurence Olivier? So they invited him and Joan and they accepted. They were the first acceptance that we got.
Wow.
And, I mean, how about that for nerves, knowing you're going out and Laurence Olivier's
on the first night.
But he was so gorgeous and we had dinner. We sat at the dinner table with them because they were like the star guests, really. And then he wrote me the most beautiful note that I treasure, obviously. He was
I've got a little poster of letters from him, from me and my girl, because he came to see me and my girl. And in fact, he used to give me business. because he loved shtick, vaudevillian. He was an old vaudevillian, really. Yeah. He loved all that stuff.
But as again, he was much older when I met him. But he was just so charming and so lovely.
Twigs, were your parents alive when you did My One and Only?
They were, but sadly, it's one of the things I really, really regret I didn't do something about. My mum, who I loved and adored, but she kind of had a nerve problem. She wasn't very well a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And she didn't like to travel. So she refused point blank to come to New York. My dad really wanted to come, and he was the musician in the family. He was the talented one. He could paint. He played by ear. He couldn't read music. But
wow.
And I grew up, because he loved all the big bands. So at home, I grew up, listening to all the big bands from the 40s and 30s. And so I think I got that musicality from my dad. And he could play saxophone. He could play piano. And he would have loved to have come, but he wouldn't leave my mum. And what I wish I'd have done, I should have got one sister to go, and because I've got two elder sisters, and we were trying to work out how we could get Dad across the Atlantic. I should have got one of them to bring him over and the other one to stay with mum. Just take him to the airport, put him on the plane and not say anything. Because I really regret that he didn't see it, because he would have loved it.
Well, of course, you did a Raw Variety performance of it, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. And mum and dad came to that. He saw the water dance.
So he did see.
Yeah. But it was sad that he didn't see the show.
Yeah, I mean, I you talk about people famous. I used to get very nervous when my mum and dad came.
Oh.
I don't know why. But I remember my dad came to, my mum came to the opening night in London of me and my girl. And then when we came to the curtain call, Frank Thornton and Emma pushed me forward, because it was a kind of community curtain call, and they pushed me forward, and the whole audience stood up. It was the very first standing ovation I've ever received. But sitting in the middle, sitting down, was my dad. Couldn't stand up. I could stand up, but didn't stand up. And I said to him afterwards, when we got to the little after-show party, I said, "Dad, you were the only person sitting down." He said, "I paid for this bloody seat. I'm sitting in it." But they came. My mum and dad came to New York probably about the third or fourth week. I got them over because they'd never flown. They'd never flown ever, and so New York was the first time. And I got them a first class ticket through the company. So you could imagine, they thought that's what flights were. But they stayed in a hotel very near where I was staying. And they found a purse in the middle of 43rd Street, a purse full of money.
Oh, my gosh.
And they took it to the local precinct, which was full of hookers and drug dealers and God knows what. And the desk sergeant said, "What?" And they said, we found this purse." And they said, "You did what? What are you doing here?" He said, "Well, we're handing it back." And then the copper called all these other coppers to have come and he said, "Look at these people, they're English, they're weird from space." Anyway, believe it or not, they found the lady.
Oh my goodness.
Who'd lost the purse.
Oh, that's such a lovely story.
I know.
Yeah, because actually in that period, we were talking about when I did my show and you did Me and My Gal, that area of 42nd Street and all was very dodgy.
Oh, my God.
I can remember the producers. We were on West 46th Street, St. James's, and they told us, you do not go to 42nd Street. I don't think we were allowed to go lower than 44th Street, I think.
That's right.
Because it was so dodgy and so dangerous. And now it's
it's like Disneyland.
I'd say it's Disneyland. It's all the Disney. They certainly cleaned that up.
Well, it's not at the moment, of course. It's completely deserted.
Of course. It must be weird in New York through this.
Well, we have cocktail parties on a Saturday night with all the cast of Me and My Girl, or most of the cast of Me and My Girl. And you forget what the Manhattanites' life is like when they're living on floor 20th of a one-bedroom apartment with dogs.
I know.
How they cope. There's us with our gardens and our...
I know.
It's a tough life.
It is tough, and I think it's really hit New York really hard.
Do with that man who's running their country.
You're quite right. But
let's not.
I don't think we can go there.
No, there's too many. I've downloaded all the White House briefings, you know, as a box set. Yeah, I think that it's the comedy gold, I think. I'm going to release them on box set.
That's hysterical. Now, the other brilliant thing that's happening, and we've got to talk about it, is they're rerunning My Family. Which is brilliant. I watched one last night. Well, we did, Lee and I. Absolutely brilliant.
It's so funny. I'd forgotten how funny it was.
Well,
you know,
Fred Barron, who's a mutual friend, as you know, I think he's one of the great comedy writers.
Well, he started that system of show running, you know, where you have a team of writers, which the BBC I'd never really approved of. And of course, the critics had a go at it because of that as well. I mean,
It was so successful.
9 years.
Oh, so they didn't know what they were talking about, did they?
You know what I'm talking about. It's the most popular. Yeah. I mean, it won every sort of popular award. You know, we didn't care. I mean, I did it. It was really curious because I'd separated from my ex. I was going through terrible times, missing my daughter, and I knew I was going to try and patch that up. My mother died. My son was born with Rosie, Sam. That was Christmas 1999. And then Fred wanted me to do My Family, and it was like a really healing time. Because it was exactly what I needed. It was a job just around the corner. It was at Pinewood Studios.
Perfect.
It was working with my old friend Zoe. I love Chris Marshall. I love the gang. And I love Fred. It was like a healing time. It was perfect.
Yeah, he's a good guy, Fred.
And we watched it the other night with the boys. And we're all howling.
We were watching one, as I say, last night. It was hysterical. There was some amazing, like your double takes are the best. You're the best double taker in the world.
Can you do double takes on podcast?
Oh, you can do it for me.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, brilliant. No, it was the one about your younger son is being bullied and Zoe invites parents over and they're like really nerdy. And you did such a brilliant double take.
I hit them with the newspaper.
You did. You start beating them up. But before that, you did such the best double take. We were on
my favourite one was last week, which, you know, I didn't see the first series at all. I never really had an inclination to watch it. No, I didn't, you know, but re-watching it now or re-seeing it or seeing it for the first time, it really makes me laugh. There was a scene last week where Zoe and I are kissing in bed, which my boys never recovered from. They used to see me in bed with Zoe, quite work when they were young. And I'm kissing Zoe, and then suddenly I removed my mouth from hers and said, "You've been seeing another dentist. Upper molar left.
That's brilliant.
It's the silliest joke.
So funny. But, you know, when we were living in LA in the early 90s, Fred Barron, who wrote My Family, you know, but
he adores you.
Oh, I love it. I love him so much. But we became friends. I forget how we met, actually. But anyway,
because he'd be doing Seinfeld
he was huge. He had huge successes and Caroline in the City. And anyway, we all lived in Hancock Park, which is a kind of old part of LA. It's rather lovely. And there's a kind of little high street there. Well, it's not a high street, but it's an area with cafes and restaurants. And you know what Fred looks like? He's got like mad curly hair and he always dresses, down dresses in kind of old T-shirts.
Yeah.
And he was, he'd gone in and got himself a coffee in one of the coffee shops and he was sitting outside because, you know, it was lovely weather. And he'd drunk most of his coffee in that, you know, those little funny cups. And he was sitting there. He said, I was in the middle of writing something and I was trying to think of what to say. And he said, I was sitting with the cup in my hand, kind of on my lap. And some guy walked by and put a dollar in. He thought he was begging. So he said, I said to my wife, I think I better go out and get some new clothes. So you were telling me about this play reading you're doing on Zoom. Explain.
Well, it's the new thing, isn't it, at the moment? And the one I'm doing tomorrow on Zoom is called Lockdown Theatre. And it's with a lot of mutual friends, I have to say. And it's a play written by, and actually, strangely enough, written by a chap who was one of the writers on my family.
Oh, really?
A chap called James Hendry, who co-wrote the very first episode, actually. Isn't that strange? Mm. Anyway, he's written this thing called Events and Moments, and we're recording it on Sunday, that's tomorrow, at 2 p.m. on Zoom, and it's building up quite an audience. But I've just watched my American friends do one called the Apple Tree Productions, or Apple Production, which is brilliant. And it's just four actors on the screen like we're doing now on this particular image. And it works really well. Maybe this is the new way forward.
For the moment, certainly, until, you know, they sort something out.
But the lockdown, I think, is affecting everyone, and our industry probably will suffer more than anyone, I think, because eventually people will go back to their offices. Mm-hmm. They will go back to their building sites, and they will go back to... But I can't see anyone going into a cinema or theatre for quite some time now.
What about TV, do you think? I mean, people have got their TVs at home, but how can actors kind of interact with each other without, I mean, you can't do love scenes for a while.
Maybe this is what we're doing now.
Mm.
Maybe this is the new way for the moment. I mean, be no snogging.
No.
No Game of Thrones or anything like that for a while, were they, darling?
No.
All that nudity and... No, anyway, I'm just digressing. But you're coping all right.
Yeah, we are, actually. We've done a lot of... as you can see the bookshelf behind me?
Yeah.
Lee spent 4 days sorting that out. And...
I thought for one horrible minute you were going to say he built the bookshelves.
No. Lee can do lots of things.
I would have been so upset if I knew he built the bookshelves.
He can do lots of things, but he always says that if he puts a shelf up, it falls down the next day. He can't.
No, I know Lee of old. We go back a very long way. I know. When I first bought my first house in Chiswick, in London, my brother came down, who's a builder. He builds houses. I mean, he's extraordinary, and he's a master carpenter. Mm. And he plastered a wall, and it looked beautiful. It was amazing. It was perfection. And on the day he finished it, I wanted to hang my first picture from my first play that I'd ever done. And I put a little tack into the plaster and hit the only cable and water pipe, which then all the plaster decided to... We stood there a bit like Laurel and Hardy looking at this as this plaster dissolved. And my brother said, "Look, I'll do the building. Why don't you stick to acting?"
Well, that's a bit like Lee as well. So, no, he didn't build the bookshelves, but he did sort them out. Look how tidy they are.
Yeah, they are. That's very tidy.
Yeah, 3 days that took.
And but are you the kind of person that will retidy it because it's in the wrong place?
No, it looks fabulous. No, he's tidier than me.
I wish I could say that, but I will tidy everything and my wife will retidy it. So it goes on and on.
And I've been knitting, and I've been, because I love knitting, and I've been doing jigsaws and lots of reading. I'm quite enjoying it. The hardest thing for me and for Lee, I think, is not seeing our kids and grandkids.
Oh,
so you've
know,
got you've got your boys at home, which
I've got my boys here. My daughter comes up now and again and sits in the garden.
I say she can't come in.
Well, she's not been in. No, I mean that would be lovely, but she sits in the garden and with the dogs hug her to bits, and then and she won't even take a cup of tea or anything while she's here. She won't share anything, and I'm going down to see her on Monday. Probably spend a little bit of time in her garden. Just you know, 6 feet apart. It's very weird, isn't it?
That's the hard... I haven't seen, my daughter and my grandchildren, who I really miss.
But we're growing vegetables, Twigs.
Well, I'm very impressed. Like you told me you built a greenhouse. So you
can't
build that bad.
My wife did. But how can you believe this? We had a greenhouse delivered as a flat pack.
Brilliant.
You know, I thought the greenhouse was going to arrive on a truck already built. It was a flat pack.
That's hysterical.
It had 7,427 pieces.
Oh, I'd be good at that because I love jigsaws.
There, oh God, you should. If you'd seen me and the two boys and Rosie and three dogs trying to erect it in the garden.
That's so funny.
There was a sitcom just around the erection of that greenhouse.
And do you go out and applaud on Thursday nights in your garden?
Every Thursday night. And of course we have Granny. We have Rosie's mother here living with us as well. So she's in her late 80s. So we have to be really careful.
Oh, yes.
And respectful of her age and mine. Actually, what am I talking about? Me and Lee have reached the vulnerable state.
Well, me as well, yeah.
Yeah, you too, babe.
But, you know, we're lucky we're kind of healthy, or as healthy as we can be.
We can be.
But we have to be careful.
Yeah, so we go out on the street and clap.
And does the whole of the village come out?
The whole village comes out and usually gathers up on the green, you know. But the thing, I get very political about this and get a bit angry about this whole thing. I mean, much as I think it's very honourable and lovely, and I love Major Tom, or Captain Tom, or Colonel Tom, as he is now, that in fact he walks around his garden 100 times to raise money for the NHS. And in fact, what I'm doing tomorrow is funds for the NHS. But, you know, I just keep saying to myself, why didn't they have the bloody funds in the first place?
Exactly.
Why are they struggling with their PPE and their, you know, their personal protection stuff?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just nonsense. And that we all know that they were trying to close the National Service for years. They've been trying to privatise it and stuff. And now they're suddenly, you know, they're all standing outside their government buildings.
Yeah, I know.
And you think, no.
Well, hopefully it'll make them rethink all the other stuff, because I think that
I don't think so.
I think we'll all go
back to the way we were, and they'll all try and get their money, you know, out of it. I mean, the hospital that I support, when my home is where I was born, in Ilkeston and Derbyshire, I mean, it was only 2 years ago they were closing the place, and the nurses were all ringing me, some of them being made redundant, and they were pleading with me to promote it on Twitter and social media and mention it. And now they're heroes.
Yeah.
Because they've all been brought back to work.
I know. And they're all underpaid. I mean, I think they should all have an immediate rise.
Yeah, it was only us that said to them, stop their parking fees. They were paying parking.
Unbelievable.
Everyone started moaning about it.
I know.
Anyway.
But they are the real heroes. And, you know, their bravery takes my breath away. The young nurses and doctors.
I don't know. And yet, you know, my brother was very, very ill and seriously ill with COVID. And in fact, it was us that rang him and said, you must ring 999 or 111 now. He said, no, I daren't. I don't want to be taken into hospital. They turned up within 10 minutes.
Wow.
Two paramedics, and immediately made him sit up. Because he'd been lying, he really was on his last knees,
oh
I have to say.
God.
And the first thing they did was made him sit up, and they said, don't lie down, because that's the, you're allowing the... Anyway, they got him through it without taking him in. His temperature was literally 1 degree under the necessary...
Oh, so he was able to stay at home?
He stayed, he carried on staying.
And is he fine now?
And the only conditions that his wife and children got were they lost their sense of taste and smell.
Oh, that's right.
So they had very mild conditions. He got it very, very seriously.
Does he know where he caught it?
No, I don't think he does. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, that's why it's so scary. You don't know, do you?
No. Mm. Well, let's stay safe, darling.
Yeah, stay safe. I hope the play reading goes brilliantly tomorrow,
as I'm sure it will. When we get in another period of our life, we'll all get back and have a hug together.
Yeah, have a big proper hug. Okay, love to you, and thank you for talking to me.
I've enjoyed it.
Wasn't it fun? Brilliant.
Yeah. Thanks, sweetie.
Talk to you soon.
All my love.
Lots of love. Bye. Oh, that was brilliant catching up with Bob. He really makes me laugh. I've known him for quite a few years now, and he always gets me dissolving in giggles. He's absolutely brilliant. And I'm very glad his brother has recovered well. If you've enjoyed listening to Tea with Twiggy, please take a moment to give us a lovely 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people to find the show. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to this podcast so you auto-magically get the next episodes for free. And do tell all your friends and family about it too. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.